Blog Talk Radio.
Hello, and welcome to Inside Scoop Live. Thanks so much for tuning in today. I'll be your host. I'm Juanita Watson, and I have invited to the program author Richard E. Roach. He is here to talk a little bit about his new mystery thriller novel, Scattered Leaves. Richard Roach was born in Galveston, Texas in 1931. He attended both Trinity University and the University of Texas and served as a drill sergeant in the United States Air Force for 4 years. Richard worked as a geologist in the oil industry for many years and invented several electronic instruments used in the detection of oil and gas. He went on to form his own company manufacturing these products with nationwide sales under Richard E. Roach, Inc. Before the oil business fell on hard times, Richard was lucky enough to sell his business for a very large sum of money and decided to retire and begin writing. Short stories of his have been published in Man's Story 2, Happy 2007, Iconoclast 2006, and Bibliophilos 2006. His first novel, Scattered Leaves, will hit the bookstores on September 1st, 2008, and his second novel in the series, Scattered Money, will be published in 2009, and I know that he has a few other projects being reviewed by publishers at this time, so I'm just so happy to have Richard on the program. Welcome, Richard.
Hello, how are you doing today?
I'm doing pretty good, and how are you doing?
Well, I'm just doing great. I'm glad to be here.
Well, fantastic. We are so happy to have you. And really, congratulations. This is your first full-length novel at this point, isn't it?
Yes, that's correct.
So, Richard, how many years has it been since you actually started this career of yours, this retirement career of writing?
I started 5 years ago.
5 years only?
But I had written, of course. All writers, they love to write, so I'd been writing for some time, but not novels or anything, not just short stories. Never tried to sell anything, though.
So it was more just for your own personal interest?
Right. The people in my family that read what I wrote didn't like it.
Oh, they did?
No, they didn't like it, but of course, the first time I sent anything up to New York, the agent told me that he rejected it, of course. And
mm-hmm.
He told me that this isn't professionally done, so you can well imagine it wasn't done professionally.
Mm-hmm.
So I've been trying to learn how to write.
So have you taken classes, or how have you brushed up on writing styles, writing techniques, and gotten yourself, you know, versed in this whole book industry?
Most of my information came from people in it that were actually writers or agents or publishers and people like that. They have all kind of information on the internet that you can get, everything from writing a query to writing a full novel.
Mm-hmm. It's amazing how much information is actually out there on the internet. So you're pretty avid in getting out there and getting on your computer and finding out what kind of information is available.
Oh yes, you can't hardly avoid it if you're in the business, because you're trying to find an agent, you're trying to find a publisher, and they all have it the way they want it presented to them, and so forth. It's just, like you said, a mass of information.
Mm-hmm. Now, when you write, Richard, do you write on the laptop, on your computer, or do you write with pen and paper?
No, I do all my writing on the computer.
Mm-hmm.
It's easy to make corrections, and of course, the old-timey way of writing on a typewriter, which in 1974, when I first started this novel, I typed it, and there must have been a million mistakes on it.
Yeah, I bet.
It's very difficult to correct the mistakes.
Mm-hmm. So So you started writing this novel in 1974?
Yes, I wrote the first draft of the first. I have three of these novels written at this time.
Mm-hmm.
And I wrote the first draft, which was about half as long as the book is, in 74. And I was very busy at the time with my business. This is before the oil field crashed.
Mm-hmm.
The oil field didn't really crash and burn until in the 80s.
Yeah.
And in the 80s, well, anyway, if you might remember in the 70s, they were having one of these oil crunches like right now. So the oil business was going great, and I didn't have a lot of time to write. And when that fellow told me that it wasn't done professionally, well, I just quit writing, and I didn't start redoing the novel until, oh my goodness, about 5 years ago.
Wow. It must have been interesting to go back to a novel that you wrote so long ago and just see it with new eyes. I mean, that's a long time in between.
Yes. Well, of course, you had to change the price, for instance, of gasoline.
You're right.
It went from about 35 cents to about $4.
Right.
So there were a lot of things, prices that had to be changed on different, and the outlook of the country and what was happening, because McCord spends a lot of time alone. And he listens to the radio and watches television and reads the newspapers like everybody else. So this all had to be changed and brought up to date.
Mm-hmm. So interesting. Okay, so let's talk a little bit about the storyline in this book. But first, I'm really interested in the more mature nature of this novel. You know, it's really not for the timid. You've included quite a lot of violence in here in this story. So I'm wondering where the idea for this, way back in the early 70s, where the idea for this novel actually came from.
Well, it's an imagination. In other words, the writer's ally, John D. MacDonald, and Donald Hamilton and Earl Stanley Gardner and Ed McBain, they don't write anymore.
Mm-hmm.
And even in 74, I had a burning desire to write something like, not necessarily like these people, but my view of it, in my voice.
Mm-hmm.
And one of the things I wanted to present in my book was there was a murder in Georgia in 74, 5, along in there, and this guy went in and he killed a whole family.
There wasn't
any need in killing them. He just killed them. And the same way with the Clutter family, if you remember that man up in Kansas.
Mm-hmm.
There wasn't any need for him to kill those people,
mm-hmm.
but he just killed them. And the thing, in my book, I'm trying to let the public know there are some bad people out there that will kill you just like you take a sip of tea. They will kill you. So you've got to keep your doors locked, and it's a good idea to keep a loaded gun on hand.
Yeah.
Because you're not going to have time to call the police. And this goes on all the time, but not in such big ways where it gets so much news. When you go in and you kill a mother and a father and four children that go down to where the baby is a two-year-old girl, that's going to get the news.
Yeah.
But, you know, since there's 100,000 people die each year in hospitals alone from getting incorrect medication and diagnosis.
Mm-hmm.
Well, I mean, you can see that they're not going to pay very much attention to the people being killed, but it's a very serious problem in this country that you don't have public executions anymore. The last public execution that we had was in 1936, and I believe it was in Kansas. But they need to have public executions. They need to have executions on the courthouse square at high noon on Saturday.
Oh, God.
So everybody can go and see what happens whenever you start killing off the people.
Mm.
But that's not the way it works.
No, it's not. Well, you know, I know that you have very strong opinions about the crime situation that's going on in this country, and I had known that was kind of an inspiration for you in writing in the way that you do, in the stories that you do. They're very much grounded in that whole message of crime. And I wonder, you know, since you've spent so many years here, you know, how you've seen crime change from when you were a youngster back in, you know, the 30s, 40s, 50s?
Well, of course, first and foremost, I didn't know much about it, but I do know that in Livingston, Texas, the county seat of Polk County, In 1938, a black man was shot with a shotgun at the back of that big, gigantic brick courthouse, and it's kind of on a hill, and his brains and blood ran down the street. And I know that there were a few murders around generally. In Polk County, you got to understand, there's not a lot of people, or weren't then. But they were still had some murders. But I believe overall the people were much more violent in the 30s. And I believe that kind of held the crime down. But, of course, that's probably because I was a kid and didn't know what was happening.
Mm-hmm.
And then, of course, during World War II, well, you better believe crime was down because many of the young men were overseas being killed by the enemy.
Mm-hmm.
So then you had to go all the way till about 48 for things to get back to normal.
Mm-hmm. I imagine that people back in those earlier times, maybe they took things into their own hands, and whereas nowadays we've got prisons and full prisons and more prisons being built every day, you know?
Oh, yes. The prisons are full of people that need to be there and some that don't need to be there.
Mm-hmm.
In the book, it points out, in Scattered Leaf, it points out how crooked the Dallas Police Department is.
Yes.
Well, that's actually factual information. And if you'll notice, the lieutenant in there, who's a good guy and helps McCord and tells McCord that he's making a mistake by being such a bull-headed idiot. But he talks about that in there, and the police department arresting people and convicting them and having dope that's pool cue, ground up pool cue, dope cue. Put on the end of the cue stick.
Mm-hmm.
Well, they ground that up in the 90s and convicted felons for having it because they said it was cocaine.
Oh, God.
And then later on, the scandal came out, and it was a terrible mess.
Mm-hmm.
And then, if that wasn't bad enough, then they had this district attorney right here in Dallas that was convicting all these people, one right after another. Unfortunately, most of them were black, convicting them, and they were totally innocent. And these were things that could get you put in the electric chair and then finally into the getting the needle.
Yeah.
And later on, when they got DNA and they checked these people out, you know, they weren't guilty.
Yeah.
So they released a number of people like that.
Yeah, what an unfortunate situation all around.
And that makes people think the police department's bad, and really and truly the police department, the thin blue line, is all we have between us and living hell.
Oh, gosh. Wow. So Richard, tell us a little bit then about your lead character, Ben McCord. We are being introduced to him in this first novel, Scattered Leaves, but I know he's going to become popping up in other novels you have, because you are writing a sequel, or a sequel will be coming out in 2009. So tell us about Ben McCord.
Well, McCord's a very simple guy. He's big and tough and strong, and he grew up in an orphan's home, and whenever he first ran into June, he didn't really know anything about love in the modern sense of the word.
Mm-hmm.
And she taught him a lot of things about being kind and considerate. And as long as everything is going all right, well, then McCord's a great guy, and he doesn't drink and get drunk and fight and all that kind of stuff. He's a nice, quiet guy who goes on his own way. But if anybody takes advantage of women or children or even a man that's weak and helpless, well, then he's going to try to help them out. Because of his upbringing, he just is a very compassionate person.
Mm.
And he runs into PJ, which is, she is, of course, a sophisticated, but highly educated dentist.
Mm.
And she helps McCord along in learning and so forth, and they work together as a team very well. And as I've said a half dozen times, he's a simple guy, so if he loves her, well, naturally he wants to marry her, so they get married. And in the second and third novel, they work together as a married team.
Okay. But then in the first novel, that's where Ben ends up coming home from being at work out in the oil field to find June, his wife, has been murdered, and that's what basically sets off the whole story in Scattered Leaves?
That is 100% correct.
Yeah.
And McCord, being the simple-minded person that he is, he decides that he's going to punish the people himself.
And he's going to take it into his own hands. He doesn't quite trust the Dallas Police Department, I guess.
He really doesn't trust the Dallas Police Department.
Mm-hmm.
But he runs into, they arrest him first. But Lieutenant Johnson soon finds out that Ben McCord was in Oklahoma, and he couldn't have possibly have committed the crime.
Mm-hmm. So he was... Okay, he was cleared.
Right, he's cleared.
And we'll be back with more Inside Scoop Live after these important announcements.
Established in 1998, Rebecca's Reads is a book review and publicity service serving a large reading audience as well as a wide community of authors, publishers, publicists, and buyers and sellers. They offer reviews of recently published books, as well as chapter readings, teasers, and videos to help you decide what book you would like to read next. Their insightful author interviews take connecting reader and author one step further, and if you decide you would like to purchase a book, an easy-to-navigate link will allow you to purchase the book immediately online. For the authors, publicists, and publishers, Rebecca's Reads has a variety of publicity services to help them market their books to their reading audience. Their services are budget-friendly and effective. For buyers and sellers, they have a monthly list of current reviews in the Book Review Index for easy browsing, as they know your time is precious and efficiency is a priority. Be sure to visit RebeccasReads.com and browse around their new space. Whatever your literary need, this user-friendly website may be just what you're looking for. Thanks for tuning in to Inside Scoop Live. Just to remind you, I'm talking today with Richard E. Roach. His new novel, Scattered Leaves, has just hit shelves, and you can find out more about Richard through his website, richarderoach.com.
And then he tries to get McCord not to go up against those people because he doesn't understand what he's going up against. And sure enough, he goes down the wrong road. He's so set on the Dallas people being crooked that he thinks the FBI is crooked too. So whenever he finds a crooked FBI guy, he just knows he's the guilty man.
Oh,
I can't go into that anymore because it'll tell you something about how the story ruins the...
Oh, no, don't tell us too much.
Yeah,
don't tell us too much.
Like all good mysteries, in the end, it's a very simple story.
It's got
a lot of turns in it.
Yeah, that's what I've heard, that there are a lot of twists and turns in this as PJ and Ben are on their way to find the killer or killers. You know, they don't know.
That's right. They don't.
Yeah.
And really, PJ, see, the reason she's working with a dentist in Colorado.
Mm-hmm.
And as it turns out, this dentist is launders money for the mob.
Okay.
Because he has money coming in, clean money coming in, and up there in a small town, they wouldn't expect anything.
Mm-hmm.
So he crosses the mob, and they come there to kill him. And then PJ goes through a terrible bout with them.
Mm-hmm.
And LaCour just happens to have been there to get his teeth worked.
Oh, gosh. So coincidence.
That's the way that they get hooked up.
Okay.
They are both taken prisoners by the bad guys. The ungodly. But the ungodly will meet their match.
There you go. They will have their day. So why did you decide to set this story, or base most of the story anyway, in Texas? Are you still living here?
Oh, yes. I live out east of Dallas and out 2 or 3 miles out of Rockwall in a community.
Okay. Now, I know you obviously you've lived in Texas for many years, and your ending takes place in the Big Thicket, and you describe the Big Thicket so eloquently. It's as if you actually have lived there, and I was wondering if you lived close to East Texas or...
Oh, yes, I've been to the Big Thicket many times. In Livingston, that I mentioned previously, that's 19 miles from the Alabama Coushatta Indian Reservation, which is actually on the edge.
Okay.
And as you go south, from the Alabama Coushatta Indian Reservation, then you get in, the Big Thicket gets wider. It starts north of there, actually, but then it goes, you might as well say, all the way nearly to the Gulf.
Mm-hmm.
And it's just, like something that time has forgotten. Hardly anyone lives in there. There's several rivers. The Sabine runs through there, and there's several creeks, smaller bodies of water that run through there. But it's just a terrible swamp. Actually, it's the first thing that was a big news in Texas was that when the people that tried to escape from serving in the Civil War.
Mm-hmm.
They would go to the Big Thicket to hide out.
Oh, is that right?
So that got the criminals to going to the Big Thicket for the people that escaped out of Huntsville or was trying to keep from being put in Huntsville.
Mm-hmm.
Then they send them over there. Well, they don't send them. They just see it's from Huntsville to Livingston, it's 38 miles, and then you got about another 25 or 30 to get into the Big Thicket. And once they get in there, no one bothers them.
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Sounds like a pretty wild, densely forested area. I know I've been over into East Texas and very close to the Alabama Coushatta Reservation that you're talking about. And I seem to remember that it's just incredibly densely forested out there.
Well, you see, they got the river on the east, and they got the Piney Wood Hills on the right,
mm-hmm.
or to the west.
To the west, mm-hmm.
And that's what hems that low area up and makes all that water, it stays in there year round, generally speaking.
Mm-hmm. It's a beautiful area. So are you going to be setting your second novel, Scattered Money? Is that set in Texas as well?
Well, yes. They're all in Texas, but they do travel around. For instance, being in PJ, when the novel starts out, we're up in Colorado, and they have an office up there. And they have the reason for that being that one of the rich millionaires that lived up there befriended them. Actually, he did that in the first novel. But anyway, in the next one, Stone is murdered. And they live in this little town in Colorado. And the sheriff, you know, wants to know about it. But I can't go into that very much because those bad guys, the ungodly, they out here east of Dallas, Ben and PJ had started a store, a big barn-like store to sell household things like washing machines and irons and dryers,
mm-hmm.
televisions, but they did sell them in a barn, but those people up there in Colorado got mad at them, came down here and blew the place up.
Oh, gosh.
So then they had to go up there and check into that.
Oh, my gosh. So you have quite a lot of tie-in with these two books. They really are sequels. You know, you would have to read the first one to fully understand the second.
Well, you could read the second novel by itself.
Mm-hmm.
You'd be all right.
Mm-hmm.
They're complete books within themselves, but naturally in the Travis McGee book, if you've read 19 books with him and Myers in there and talking to one another, you're going to know the background better.
Yeah.
When he says something about the Green Ripper, well, you'll know what he's talking about. It was a childhood misstatement.
Mm-hmm.
And there is no Green Ripper.
Mm-hmm.
But, things like that there. But each book is separate.
It sounds like some of these authors that you used to read and enjoy and probably still do really were a great inspiration for you in your writing style now.
Say that again about my writing style. I didn't understand that.
Well, it sounds to me like the books and the authors that you enjoy to read.
Oh, the authors that I like?
Yeah, it sounds like they've really influenced how you write personally.
Well, yes, they really do.
Mm-hmm.
You know, for instance, John D. MacDonald. Have you ever read anything he wrote?
I have not, no.
Okay. Well, it's hard to talk about Travis McGee if you never read a book.
But I've heard.
How about Matt Helm? You saw picture shows, maybe.
Mm-hmm, mm-hmm.
Of course, the picture shows with Dean Martin playing Matt Helm were made as a joke.
Right.
Whereas in reality, Donald Hamilton's Matt Helm was a very serious government agent,
mm-hmm.
that was tortured and had all kind of bad things done to him, of course. And then Earl Stanley Gardner, he's the man that wrote more novels than anybody else.
Yeah, yeah.
Over 300 novels, and everybody knows nearly about Perry Mason.
Yes.
Not so many people know about Donald M.
Mm-hmm.
Do you know about Donald Lamb?
I do not. I'm getting quite an education today from you.
Okay. he's got probably 30 books about Donald Lamb.
Oh.
He's a private detective.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas Perry Mason, of course, is a lawyer.
Mm-hmm.
But what I got from him, Earl Stanley Gardner has so many crooks and turns and so many people doing this, that, and the other, after he tells you who the murderer is, you wonder about it.
Mm-hmm.
But have you watched any of the Perry Mason shows, maybe on television?
Oh, sure. Mm-hmm.
Well, didn't you sometimes wonder at the end of them, how could that person be the murderer?
Oh, yes, of course.
Well, that's the way it seems to me. Anyway, then probably the last man would be Ed McBain, whose real name was Evan Hunter. Did you ever read anything by him?
I have heard about Evan Hunter. Mm-hmm.
Well, he had the 87th Precinct novels.
Mm-hmm.
And then in a separate, that's about police, all police work. And then he had the Matthew Hope novels, where Matthew Hope is a lawyer in Florida.
Mm-hmm.
Whereas the 87 Precinct novels, all that was really, they happened in New York, but he called it another name.
But
so that's it. Earl Stanley Gardner,
uh-huh.
Ed McBain, Donald Hamilton, and John D. MacDonald. They all taught me. I've read everything they've written.
That's a lot of reading. I'm wondering if you plan on putting out as many novels as some of these authors that you're emulating. I mean, that's a lot of writing.
Well, yeah, I write all the time, and I have several novels that don't have anything to do with, of course, with Ben McCord and PJ.
Mm.
But they're all crime novels with one exception. I wrote one army novel.
Oh, okay.
It's a historical deal where in World War II, soldiers were sent to an island in the Pacific in 1940 to build an airstrip. And while they're building it, of course, it gets to be December of 41 and the Japs bomb them. And of course, you're not supposed to say Japs now because the Japanese are our best friends in the Pacific.
Mm-hmm.
But you have to think about them as Japs if it's 1941.
Yes, if you put it in context for the time. Mm-hmm.
Well, yeah, I don't have the people in there talking about the Japanese. But at that time, it was that red sun on the side of one of those silver or sometimes black planes was the worst thing that could happen.
Mm-hmm. So, Richard, what do you find is the most challenging aspect of the whole book industry with writing or publishing? What have you found at this point has been your biggest challenge area?
It's harder to get an agent than anything else. Now, let me classify that. I don't mean any agent. You can get an agent, but you cannot get, I'm going to call them New York agents. Now, they may not live in New York, but it's necessary for your agent to have worked with the book publishing people in New York if you're going to really get a novel on the top level.
That's a good point.
And to try to get a New York agent whenever they're receiving 1,000 queries a week, well, it's very difficult to do that.
Yeah.
And likewise, you can't get Simon and Schuster to even look at your manuscript unless you have an agent.
Mm-hmm.
So I would say, getting a New York agent, even if they live in Kansas, but they work 20 years in New York, well, that's the New York agent is hard to get.
Yeah, I imagine so. But getting the right agent for you is very, very important.
If you're going to sell to the big publishers, it's a necessity.
Yes. And I guess do your research, right? Because there's so much information out there when you're surfing around on the internet. You really have to research your resources and your contacts to make sure that you're getting hooked up with people that really are on the up and up and have your best interests at heart.
Oh, absolutely.
Mm-hmm.
There's plenty of people saying they're agents, and the first thing they want you to do is send them $300 or $400.
A check, yes.
To cover their expenses of doing whatever, mailing and printing the manuscript. That's what the excuse they have, of course.
Mm-hmm.
They probably don't print and don't mail, but you can get those kind of agents very easy.
Yeah, yeah. So, Richard, let me ask you, what does your family think now of your writing career, now that you have your first novel published?
I think I could explain that best telling you the way it was in 1949 when I started playing the violin. My wife says, what on earth are you making that screeching sound for?
Mm-hmm.
And I said, well, you know, I just thought I'd learn how to play the violin. And she said, well, I just can't stand it. Get out of my hearing if you got to play. And since our house at that time was only two rooms, it wasn't very easy to get out of our hearing. Well, you know, I eventually learned how to play a violin and got a job in a band while I was in the service. I played in a band and then finally got my own band. This is all while I was in the service. And immediately thereafter, when I was going to Texas, I played music then, too. But anyway, I think they view it just like that. You know, he's crazy. No one on earth that has plenty of money and food and so forth is going to spend all the time working like that.
Mm-hmm.
And at my age.
Mm.
But I enjoy it, and I have to do it.
Yes, absolutely. Well, good for you for sticking with it. And from what I have seen, reviewers of Scattered Leaves love your writing. So I think you are certainly onto something.
Thank you very much. I appreciate that. There's a lot of folks that don't.
And that's okay. Not everyone is going to like what you do. That's just a fact of life, isn't it?
That's 100%. True.
Yeah.
Somebody ought to be able to express their opinion without fear of somebody shooting them in the stomach or in the head or cutting their throat.
There you go. I agree with that. Well, I want to mention your website, Richard. It's www.richarderoach.com, and I know that you're doing some work on it right now. But I am sure that it will be up and running as soon as possible.
Well, that's great. I'm glad to hear it. I hope everybody goes and looks at it.
Yes, yes. Well, Richard, I want to just thank you so very much for coming on the program today. Did you have any final thoughts you wanted to share with listeners?
No, I think we've covered it all. I had a great time talking to you. You know, old folks like me, that's what they do best, is run off at the mouth.
Well, it has been such a pleasure, and I hope to have you back when your second book, Scattered Money, comes out. It's just been a great time talking with you, Richard. So best to you, and you have a wonderful day.
The best to you, too. So long for now.
Take care. All right, listeners, I have been talking with Richard Roach. His first book is on shelves now, just hit shelves. It is called Scattered Leaves. And it is just getting incredibly good reviews. So I hope you've enjoyed this interview. Please go check out his website, richarderoach.com, and look for this book. If it's not in your local bookstore, it is definitely available through online booksellers. You just have to look for it. And then, you know, his sequel is coming up in 2009. So keep an eye on this guy. I have a good feeling about him. So thank you once again for listening to Inside Scoop Live. I'm Juanita Watson, and until next time.